Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 195, Tara, Yoga, and Female Buddhas.
Star Trek movie, where they discovered this entity who had a very pleasant female voice called V'ger. They called her V'ger because they saw the letters V and then G-E-R on the side of a sort of machine thing at the nexus of this vast entity, which was destroying worlds. The entity was destroying worlds. It was digesting them. Destroying was coming toward the Federation headquarters on Earth. And Captain Kirk and Dr. Spock, they were out there. And an actor named Frank Converse, who happened to be a friend of mine from when I was little, was playing a sergeant somebody, you know, one of the officers. But he was expendable. He was obviously only in that one movie. Because they couldn't stop this entity. The reason that it was destroying worlds was it wanted to understand everything. And then it particularly was intrigued by human beings. And they wanted to understand them, but then its only way of understanding was to sort of like chew them up and digest them. You know, but then that didn't help. She couldn't understand them by doing that. Once said she, because it had a female voice, but it was a machine. But really powerful. I mean, it was swallowing galaxies, you know, practically. So then Frank Converse, he volunteered, look, I will merge with you, and you can, I'm not a Vulcan, but I'll merge with you, and then you can understand me, and you don't have to destroy me. But I'm willing, if you do, that's okay. But then you'll know what a human being really is. You know, you'll get into my soul and emotions and everything, you know. So then the two of them was like a yab-yum, you know, like a male-female union of, and they turned out V'ger was Voyager that had been sent out from America in the 20th century, you know, two or three centuries earlier than Star Trek, right? So then the man and the computer merged, you know, in this erotic thing. And then somehow there was kind of like, oh, now I understand. And then it disappeared, you know. But it disappeared with like waves going out like that. So you had the idea that it sort of encompassed everything. And Frank went with her. You know, he disappeared too. Like his ordinary coarse human body, he dropped completely. But he was a hero. You know? So that sort of was enlightenment or something like that, I think. I'm afraid. Man, male, female, and supercomputer. In union. What? It was a Star Trek movie. It was a Star Trek movie. It was the old one, you know, with the old Kirk. It was the old one. Thank you. I want to say one thing to everybody just to say that I'm so happy. I'm so always so happy when Richard and Mary come. This is my last class. We have two more talkathons together tonight and tomorrow morning. But this is the last class I'm doing solo. And I'm just always so happy. It's really, really special, I feel. And somehow, you know, the Buddha tradition was nested in with all the other Indian traditions, which were all very pluralistic, always have been. Because India is not one country. It's like 100 countries. And city-states it was in those days. Then there were different empires, then multiple empires. And multiple languages and so on. But during that period, from the mid or early first millennium before the Common Era to the beginning of the second millennium of the Common Era, the Buddhist-Hindu interaction, symbiosis, was really good, actually. And they enriched each other, and it was really nice the way it was fitted together. And sometimes they were debates, and they had disagreements and conflicts and things. They never had a religious war, but they did have competition. You know, they had intellectual battles. And philosophers always do have battles, you know. And so I always feel that when Richard and Mary represent like India as it is, you know, the spiritual side of India as it is. And you know, there's this amazing thing happening in the 20th and 21st century, which is that due to the shattering of Tibet by the military-industrial lifestyle mediated through the poor Chinese people who used to have better cooking and were more relaxed and never did go out to conquer the world. They refrained from sending out their... I mean, they sent out their Columbus, but then they came back because they preferred to stay in China. And instead of conquering and genociding the people which they found. But they went out in much bigger ships than Columbus had in the 100 years earlier, at least. So anyway, I love the interconnect, you know, therefore, yes, the Tibetans are bringing back this Buddhist component in India. I think I told you the story, Richard, and I believe, of Dhirendranath Shastri, famous Indian philosopher, professor at Agra University, who was a specialist in Nyaya Vaisheshika, all the way through from the original Sutra, Vaisheshika Sutra, Nyaya Sutra, all the way through to the Navya Nyaya, you know, in Bengal and so on, in the second millennium. But then there was this huge problem that he couldn't figure out what the great Shastrakaras, the makers of the treatises of the Nyayikas, what they were debating about when they started writing long commentaries, which they're only ones extant are a good 800 years after the original sutra. And although they do refer, they quote intervening ones that were written earlier, but they still... And then who they debating with? And then nobody could answer his questions. He went to the Vidyalayas of Mysore, of Calcutta, of Bombay, of Madras, Chennai, everywhere he went, Bangalore. He went to all the places where all the Brahmins were, and no one could answer his question. And then he read a book by a Russian, Shcherbatsky, called Buddhist Logic. And he was introduced to the writings of Dignaga and Dharmakirti through Shcherbatsky. And then he found there are a few Sanskrit texts left of theirs, not all of them, but some of them, some parts of them. And it blew his mind. And in his book, great book that he wrote, called Critique of Indian Realism, he has a parampara in Sanskrit in the dedication page, and he has to spell Shcherbatskaya, Russian in Sanskrit, not easy to spell. And it's like, you know, that is the great scholarly effort of the age that unfortunately is not being pursued, which is to reconnect each strand of tradition with that long interaction period, you know, which was so creative and fertile, you know, because the caste system was eroded there were these big universities where people could go from any caste, and so the monasteries had become the cores of big universities. So it was really quite marvelous. So anyway, I feel I taste that. This place, we just never changed the metal letters. We're so, like, for 15 years now. But Nina insisted from the beginning this room was to be called, or this building is to be called the Nalanda Conference Center. Nalanda Conference Center, you know, which is, it was the most famous university. But that was one of many. But someday we'll get NALANDA. Now it just says Conference Center. We'll put Nalanda Center. Please remind me, Justin, to do that when on downtime. Any other questions? Last words, comments of this set of things? As it turned out, a number of us who were here, who were at the Kala Chakra in Bodh Gaya, we did receive this initiation from the Dalai Lama. This Chijanamuche, which is in the same lineage, because Chijanamuche was his junior tutor, and he received himself through Chijanamuche. This particular form of Tara, Chinta Chakra. Yes?
When you spoke of the chakras, you said that it was a software.
Yes.
But then when we speak of the Vayus, the Vayu, Nada, and Bindu,
yeah,
it does become something that is material, right?
Well, yeah. So software is material. Software is material. It's just flexible. It's fluid. It's not just one thing. In other words, we don't have to have a battle over, no, the heart chakra faces this way, the lotuses are that color, the other. It's the central nervous system, and it can be programmed this way or that way.
Right.
But programming is physical. It's a pattern. It holds energy. It has to be somewhat physical.
But we do have in our form now, in our physical form now, the bindu, the vayu, and the nada. So
we have chakras, you're saying?
Well, we have
sort of, you can say that.
The bindu.
I'm pretty sure I could show the picture. Yeah. You can say that we have chakras, but in a way they're kind of knotted off, and there's no sort of wheel or flower. Chakra means, of course, a wheel, but then they're presented like flowers with petals, and then whatever, you know. It's not like there's a thing like that. But you can impose a patterning like that, which will then channel the vayu, will travel in patterns like that. There's a meditation that you could actually. We could do that meditation. You could, you know, since no one has any questions, we have a couple of minutes. You know, what you do is do it. Do one little last meditation. We'll do it. Okay. Go in meditative mode. Imagine that central channel we talked about yesterday, Sushumna or Avadhuti, and think of it as fairly good sized, like a bigger than a fat straw, like a tube. Okay? And then imagine your own awareness as like a little eye or a little being that's mostly just eye. It's inside that central channel. Okay? And then you can start out with that little awareness being, with a visual awareness, in the center of the central channel there, at the level of the heart center. But that's, of course, in the center of the body, back near the spine, in front of it. It's not the spinal column itself, it's in front of it. And then imagine that you turn clockwise 360 degrees. Imagine you're facing forward to start with, and in front of you is a little opening of a tube. And then every 45 degrees is another tube in this little chamber you're in. And imagine your awareness turns and sees those eight tubes. Okay? It looks down the eight tubes. And sort of with your look, your wishing look, it sort of smooths the tubes and makes them sort of open and pliant, and they feel kind of rubbery and lively, you know, springy. And then just spin round like that and see the eight tube openings. And then if you wanted to get more into it, you would go into that into any one of them, and then you would see that divide in two, actually in three. There'd be three tube openings, they would be like white, blue, and red, the interiors of the next set of channels, etc. You could do that. But then what you do is, because you're in the central channel, then let your little point of awareness, you've sort of looked through those eight things, then let your awareness sort of rise up in the central channel, hitch a ride with the dana vayu or prana vayu, and just go up the central channel to the throat level, and then you come into the same kind of a chamber in the throat level. But here you have the straight ahead in front of you and a little tube opening in the wall of the chamber. And then you have one, two, three. So there's four in the sector as you turn to the right until you're 90 degrees, you know. There's three, therefore, in between. Okay? So this is going to be 16. You're going to see a total. And then you're going to spin around very slowly, looking tube by tube, looking into each tube, like shining a light in it, and there's the front tube right in front of you. Always that's considered the east, actually, is wherever you're facing. And then you go toward the south. And then there are three tubes that you look down. And then you come to the one that's on a right angle. And then you do keep turning, and then there's three more And then you're looking straight back to the west. And then again, three more, and you're going to the north. And three more, you come back to the east. So that you have a sense of being in this little central chamber, and you're looking out through 16 of these little tubes. Just to sort of get used to the living in the software, in the hologram. And then you could, after you do that, if you're trying to do each one, you're probably only six or seven around. Then you can go up again, up the central channel, and come up to the crown level under your skull. And then you have 32 little holes in the wall of the same kind of little chamber. And you go around and you smooth out all 32 of those. So that is sort of a visualization of yourself with a subtle awareness, traveling around an ideal imagination of a chakra system. Now, when you say there's something really there, well, if you do that, you're going to get sensations in your nervous system. You will feel, say, if you do it meditatively with real concentration, you will feel things in your system. You will. And it could be quite strong if you have done it a lot. And but it isn't like you find the bunch of wheels there. You have all these complicated nerves, and you kind of shape and smooth them out into something like that in your mind. But it's like, you know, in a way you're making a structure, and then the micro level of that structure is like, you could, it's like one of those things you write on, the kids will write on to write letters, and then they shake it or they turn a little thing and it all wipes out what they wrote. So in that sense, as I said, it's half software, not hardware. And then later you get to where there's deities in these different petals, right in the central chamber, and then there's, and they move around and do things. And then each one of those tubes leads to a particular part of the body. And then the deity is the tube. And the male, the female is the inside of the tube, the male is outside of the tube, and then one is out on the body and one is in at the heart chamber. So there's all kind of really fantastic things. But you have to develop one point in this first, for example, and that takes to be able to really do that. And there you might just look at anything and then develop the ability to absolutely hold your mind stock still for some period of, quite a period of time. And that's tough. Okay. Oh, one thing. Yesterday I had a discussion about the multiple life perspective with Chodong, which is still, I agree with Buddha, is the most useful biological theory that any proto-Darwinian or neo-Darwinian could even imagine, because it connects to the lives of people, makes them understand and some experience their own biology. But anyway, in talking about it, she asked me, which I never properly answered, like, how do you get to see how that feels, and how do you really see that? And then I said, you read a lot of stuff, but I didn't really get into the list. We have the narrative of the one life, you know, and there's so many things. You know, go for it. You only live once. You know what I mean? There are all these slogans people say in bars, you know, which are all totally intuitive to us. You know, we think, oh, that's correct, right? We would think that. So the point is, there's like a collection in Sanskrit, which has been translated by various people, called the Kathasaritsagara, the ocean of streams of stories. Then the Buddha started it off a lot, actually. Some of the earliest of these kind of animal stories and things come from the Buddha's Jatakas, what are called Jatakas. Jataka means his recounting of a previous life. And he was, when he was a monkey king, and what he did, when he was the deer king. I love it when he was the deer king. Do you know that one? He was the king of the deer. Do you all know that one? He was the king of these marvelous deer. And he was a He was very long-lived, and he was big, and he had the antlers, and he was golden, kind of like a pelt. And he made a deal with the king of Benares many aeons, a long time ago, many centuries before the time of Buddha, whatever. And he could talk, that deer. And so he made a deal, and he said, you send your hunters out for venison. And they just shoot up a storm, and they kill a lot more of my herd than they need to, that you need, Your Majesty, and that people really need. And then they just leave the carcasses to rot. And only a little bit of it is used. So I tell you what, we'll have a lottery on our deer community, and one deer will show up at the kitchen every day for Your Majesty, and then leave the other deer alone. Okay? We'll come freely of our own accord. Send the hunters off somewhere else to do something else. So this had been made by maybe the father or grandfather of the current king. And then it so happened that one day there was a doe whose turn came up, but she was quite pregnant. And she was running around the herd asking someone to swap places with her, promising to take their place or even move them a day later by inserting herself in the queue the minute she had given birth and brought up to the point this young one, because why kill two? But nobody would change their thing. No one would switch days with her. And so she was disconsolate, and this came to the attention of the king of the deer. So he said, oh, no problem, I'll take your turn. So then he went, and then he came to the kitchen, and like, okay, I'm here for dinner. And then the cook was freaked, because A, the thing was talking, and B, it was so glorious and radiant. And he thought it might be a magic deer, and so the cook didn't butcher him right away. Instead, he sent a messenger up to the king through the different flunkies, you know, and he said, to tell the king he has to come down to make a decision about the menu tonight. I can't do this on my own. Please forgive me, Your Majesty. And so the king came down, and then the king saw that this was the deer, and he asked him why he had come. And why, well, you're the king. Why are you coming? And then the Buddha / king of the deer said, well, I'm coming because I'm the king and I'm responsible for everything. And I made the deal with your grandfather. And this doe, I agree with the doe, there's no sense killing her fawn as well as herself. So I'm going to give myself, you know. But, you know, I have lots of meat. You can smoke some of it and keep it in the icebox. And then the king freaked and he said, wow, you are really giving me a lesson. You're better than me. I'm into this thing like, well, the king sends out the soldiers to die. The king never goes out and risks their life or gives them. You're a king who gives your life for your subject. That's amazing. I think we won't eat any of you guys anymore. And then they were vegetarians after that. And they didn't eat the king either. And then they didn't eat the dough either anymore. So there's thousands of those stories. And there's some humorous and weird ones, too. There's some really fun and weird ones. One I like particularly is about ethics. It's called Mahabodhi, and there was this guy who was a sage, and he was a favorite of a certain king. And the king was his patron, and he had a meditation hut in the garden of the king, and the king used to take teachings from him and so on. And then some evil ministers, six ministers, started bad-mouthing the guy and saying that he was like giving bad advice to the king, and he really had designs on power, and you know, the king's favor was spoiling him, and he was going to ruin the kingdom, etc. And they poisoned the king's mind against him. So the king went over to him one day, who wasn't kind of, he was in denial that his mind was poisoned. And then he said to the king, I think I'm going to leave. I'm going to the forest for a while, you know. Thank you, Majesty, you're so kind to have me living here. But I think I will leave now because, you know, it's a problem, you know. He said, no, it's not a problem. I want you to stay. But then the king's dog, who was there, started growling at the sage. So then the sage, yeah, you're saying that, Your Majesty, but your real feelings are betrayed by your dog, you see, who is now, you are thinking these bad thoughts and the dog is growling, and that dog used to always like to be petted by me. And so it means your mind has turned, so I think I'm not going to press the point. And he left. And then the bad ministers all gave advice to the king. They were thrilled to get rid of this real sage. And they were giving horrible advice to the king because one of them was a nihilist One of them was a fatalist. One of them was another some kind of extremist. And they were all different kinds of extremists, in other words. And they were saying to the king, it doesn't matter what you do, or like, don't bother with that, or, you know, everybody will be dead anyway, so it doesn't matter. You don't have to do any public works. You don't have to help the sick or the old. In other words, the country was going to ruin. It was too much poverty and too many thieves, and too much violence was not controlling it, and so on. So then the sage, sort of with his clairvoyance, he knew this from afar. And he felt sorry for the citizens, for the king, who was his old friend, and for the citizens. So he thought, well, I really shouldn't step out of the way of those idiots who are giving him bad advice. So he created a magic monkey. He manifested a monkey. He near emanated a monkey. And then he killed the monkey and skinned it. But it was just his emanation. But anyway, so then he came into the court, like as if he was visiting, with a dripping, grisly, wet, fresh monkey skin. And then, because he was an old friend of the king was received him respectfully. He was a little freaked out with the blood dripping off the monkey skin. But he thought, well, you know, holy men, they do weird things. And wasn't saying anything. And then all the six ministers went completely nuts. And they said, like, you are horrible. Now we really see your true nature. Because they were afraid he was going to come back. You know? So they said, you look at you, that poor animal you killed. That's really terrible. You slaughtered some monkey, and then you go around wearing its unsanitary skin. It's horrible, all this kind of thing. So they went on and on about it. So then he then says, well, he says, why to them? And then each one gives their dumb philosophy, and on the basis of that philosophy, they have no reason why he shouldn't have killed that monkey. You know, the monkey's really just a matter, and there's no soul. B, it's fatal, that was the karma of the monkey. You know, all A, B, C, all their different theories. So he proved that their theories made it perfectly all right to do any heinous thing. And then the king is really impressed that these ministers who are giving him how to run the country are unable to come up with a sensible reason of why you would be kind and gentle with the monkey and nonviolent with the monkey. And so then, after finishing them off, the sage, he whips off the wet monkey skin and he brings the monkey back to life. And the monkey scampers off and goes and jumps in the garden in a tree. And the king sees the light and so on. And then those six guys become six people in the Buddha's life who argue with the Buddha about the nature of reality and lose also. So they're but they have all these little things like the thing about the dog barking, growling. You know, like they're such great storytellers. Actually, there's one Sanskrit scholar I know who found 40% of the stories in the Decameron came from the Indian stories, you know, because he didn't have to give copyright notice or whatever in those days. You know, Boccaccio, you know, the Renaissance. You know. Through Persia, these things came, you know. Okay, I think it's dinner time. Thank you, Alan. And the great yoginis. And the great teacher. Well, we're meeting again tonight, right? We're chatting again tonight. We're going to have some fun tonight.
Greetings and salutations, podcast Wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at the Buddha and Yogis Dharma and Yoga Intensive held annually at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa. This all-level program brings together some of the greatest and most compassionate yogis and yoginis of the various lineages together with Robert Thurman to Tibet House's Retreat Center in Phoenicia, New York. This is a great program for experienced yogis and those looking to explore yoga either as a possible practice or looking to begin a daily practice. Be sure to visit tibethouse.us and menla.us for more information on this annual program. This year, Robert Thurman will be joined by dear friends Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor. As we heard in the first half of this week's episode, Bob loves teaching with the various yogis and yoginis, and especially with Richard and Mary, who bring a deep contextual background to the history and the intersection of yoga and Buddhism. Second half of this week's episode is a deep dive into the practice of Tara. Professor Thurman will be guiding us through a traditional adaptation of the 21 Taras practice, which can be adapted for various deities within the Tara pantheon. I'm just getting familiar with yellow Tara myself. If you look on this week's description, we've got a great image of the yellow Tara with her fierce nature kind of coming out in her teeth and facial expressions. It's a great statue, a little bit scary, but Professor Thurman explains how the different aspects of Tara can help anyone, Buddhist or non-Buddhist, overcome difficult situations in their life through meditation and contemplation of her rich tradition. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to VIP events like 2019's Carnegie Hall concert put together by Tibet House Vice President and co-founder Philip Glass. To learn more about this annual celebration, ringing in the Tibetan New Year held at Carnegie Hall, benefiting the work of Tibet House US and Menla Retreat, please visit tibethouse.us. Hope to see you there. Should be a great lineup this year. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Gary Gock with a reading of Emily Dickinson.
So you have to use your own mind now. So can you remember, does anybody have, I don't even have the paper for the white Tara thing. We could do that. So I think you can go into a meditation. And, oh, great. Well, yeah, you know, I don't want us to read it, though. I want us to just, but thank you. Maybe I will refer to it. So we can go, thank you. We'll go into the meditation and quickly run through the different preparatory steps, which we did yesterday, but this time we're going to do it much quicker. So then you decide, I want to do Tantra, right? So then in Tantra, what could be better than to meet Arya Tara in her 21 main forms, but there's innumerable forms of Tara. And so when you're interested in healing, you meet the white Tara, if that's your sort of the activity that you're interested in, peace and healing, and you need that. So you do white Tara, the Chinta Chakra Tara that we meditated on. And so the way of imagining the presence of Tara is like she comes in the sky. Then, you know, sort of changing the scene, you had all the gurus and the heavenly hosts in the sky above you. And if you want to feel, have a sense of thinking that's there, you should always feel that when you meditate, by the way, that your teachers are present because their attention and their awareness, in fact, is present in a true spiritual teacher to all their students all the time. But when you imagine them in some sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi form, you're therefore really tuning into the fact. that you are connected to them by having learned from them. And so then in front of them, all of the miraculous, all of the compassion and the bliss and the miraculous wonder-working energy crystallizes into White Tara, Chinta Chakra. And so then you just imagine she's sitting there smiling at you beautifully, holding that, you know, that gesture and holding the stalk of the lotus of a lily or lotus or a peony that she, over her shoulder. Sitting in front of you there. And she's in the, her legs are crossed, so she's in a healing mode. And then so the first thing you do when such an honored guest come is you offer water. You offer them to wash their hands. You offer them to rinse the dust from their mouth to take some water. You offer them to wash their feet. You then offer all kind of cloth, a nice towel for them, a silken or a fine cotton towel for them to dry their hands and their touch their face about with. And then you offer perfume, and you offer flowers, and you offer incense, and you offer food, and you offer music. Whatever the guest likes, you imagine offering that. And you then just enjoy being bathed in the glittering white light emanation from Tara and from her special beacon, like a lighthouse beacon, is the Tam letter on the wheel at her heart. Tam. You can see it in English, T-A-M, Tam. And then you feel so comfortable in her presence. And she wants you to be able to really keep that kind of comfort with you, because then you can manifest it to other beings. So she sort of, you invite her, and she, after some time, and then she merges with you. And you feel yourself to be like a Tara. And you feel your body to be this glowing white, and holding this lotus and making this gesture, and with the syllable Tam in your heart, and all those many mantra syllables you can have in there too. You don't really, if you don't remember them exactly, never mind, but a lot of really meaningful and powerful seed letters are there in the wheel in the heart. And then you imagine that you repeat the mantra quietly and slowly. Om Tara Tutari Ture. Say. Mama Ayu Punya Jnana Pushtim Kuruye Swaha. So then you, after repeating that a certain amount of time, where you're invoking White Tara, although you yourself feel you are White Tara, but you're also invoking White Tara to help increase, use her miraculous power to increase your lifespan, your merit, and your knowledge, your intuitive knowledge, your wisdom, and push them kuruye, make it grow, you know. And then you, at the end of anything like that, you do some what they call thank you offerings. Again, you visualize giving all kind of beautiful things and to all these divine beings, enlightened beings. And then you dedicate the merit and any knowledge gained through the meditation and the merit gained through the meditation, the different levels of meditation, you dedicate all of that to let it be a cause of my swift attainment of perfect Tarahood, perfect Buddhahood, for the sake of all beings, so that I can really be the one who really can help them accelerate their own progress into the bliss of nirvana, you know, and the non-dual nirvana and samsara. You know. And finally, so that's one Tara which we experimented with a little bit. And then there's another one, there's a red Tara, there's several red Taras, But the red one is kind of interesting, and I just wanted to share it with you. It's sort of on the path to the Vajrayogini, who is bright red, you know, who is ruby. And the red form of the goddess is the dominatrix form, the powerful one. And Kurukula, she has a hook, like an elephant goad. You know, it's like an elephant goad hook in one hand. And there are different forms of her. And another one, she has a bow made of flowers with flower arrow. And the bowstring is made of a string of bees. But they're magical bees so that she actually can shoot the arrow. And the arrow is the arrow that captivates the mind or fascinates whoever she strikes with the arrow. And so the dynamic one is where if you get good at it, and you get where you can, you have to get initiated, of course, and if you get good at it, you can then sort of think of a situation in the world where the Dharma is being oppressed, you know, or where people are being harmed, you know, where they're losing their medicine, or their doctors, or their hospital, or their caretakers, or, you know, and you can shoot your arrow toward the mind of the evildoer who is doing that harmful thing to them, and you can attract them with your beauty and your arrow, and you can cause them to think more benevolently and more lovingly in a sort of very powerful and dominant way. Not just say, gee whiz, I wish they wouldn't be like that. Of course, that involves not settling into whatever they think they are supposed to be thinking and whatever their limits of thinking are. You crash right through that when you're in that Kurukula mode. You know, she dances up on one foot like that, and she's got her bow and arrow and her hook and her lasso, you know, the forearmed one, you know, a hook and a goat hook and a lasso. So you can just imagine doing that. I think Arianna Huffington, I think, is a bit like that. In her great book about the pigs at the trough, you know, about the 0.01%. That was really quite good, I thought. So that's where you're extending your positive, loving, liberating, you know, saving, you know, goddess energy into turning the thoughts of the world in the direction you think they should go, which is towards gentleness, love, beauty, creativity, and not greed and harmfulness and dark behavior and dark thoughts and dark actions. So you might learn about, as you go along, you might learn about the red forms also. The white ones are this pacifying, you know, the yellow ones are prospering. If you want to raise a lot of money to save all some children in some terrible African country or something, then you can do the yellow one. One of the yellow taras. And do and perform wealth meditations, abundance meditations. And then you can do the dominating thing. And then, heaven forbid, you have to do the destructive one. Just really dealing with the really bad eggs. But the only time when a bodhisattva would be actually destroy some entity, even a demon, would be in the line of preventing that demon from doing things to, not only from preventing them from harming the beings that they're harming, but preventing them from accumulating the evolutionary momentum by harming others, that of receiving so much further harm themselves. And so sometimes you can't fasten them in your lasso and get them to think more positively and more creatively and more love by the dominating thing. And then you have to be like Durga, you know, you have to be, or Kali, you know, you have to be more ferocious. You know? But you have all of those potentials, is the point. You're totally capable of all four of them. The many great yogis in Tibet and in India too, they only did Tara. That's all they did. The Tara was the one. You know?
Emily Dickinson, who lived from 1830 to 1886, born into one of the prominent families of Amherst, Massachusetts. She was educated at Amherst Academy and attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary for a year. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will include with ease and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for lift them pound for pound, and they will differ if they do, as syllable from sound. I'm Gary Gock, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House, U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.